Hello and welcome to another episode of Podcast DX, the show that brings you interviews with people just like you whose lives were forever changed by a medical diagnosis. I'm Lita.
I'm Ron.
And Jean Marie will not be with us today. She's down with a migraine. Collectively, we're the hosts of Podcast DX. Joining us today is Crystal Kent. Crystal Kent is a disabled Army veteran living with fibromyalgia who served with the 256th Combat Support Hospital. Crystal also worked in social services for over 20 years in a variety of roles, from adult advocacy coordinator, a care coordinator, assertive community treatment specialist, benefit coordinator, and supported employment services. She also assisted individuals with intellectual disabilities, mental health conditions, and veterans alike. And she is a repeat customer. We've had her on the show a couple of times already, and we're very grateful that she's able to be with us again today to honor Heart Awareness Month, and that's your teaser. Hello, Crystal.
Hi. Thank you for having me again. I feel special.
You are. You are special.
I laughed when Lita was saying that you're a repeat customer.
Yeah, I know. But hey, I'm a happy customer, and hopefully, obviously you guys are too if you're having me again.
Absolutely. Well, anybody that's a dynamo like you, we've got to get on often. Crystal, what happened during your recent visit to the emergency room at the hospital?
So on January 17th, 2023, I woke up and I wasn't feeling quite right. And as my symptoms progressed, I woke up feeling a little bit disoriented and nauseous. And then I started having pain kind of centralized in my upper left, like shoulder and chest area. And then it started radiating down my arm and hand. And then my arm and hand went numb. And then I got so nauseous that I started vomiting. And at that point, I was like, this is not normal. And as you outlined, I have fibromyalgia, which causes a lot of similar symptoms from pain to nausea, vertigo. But this was different. And then after about 20 minutes, I was like, you know what? This might be heart related. So I should go to the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I went.
Okay.
All right. Well, thank you for that. It's good to have you back, Crystal. This is Ron. The American Heart Association and the National Institutes of Health, they both recognize that some people will have a heart attack and not even know what's happened, as they did not notice any symptoms. There are, however, a number of symptoms commonly associated with myocardial infarction.
Well, she already listed hers. She had pain and nausea.
Yep.
We didn't know that at the time. So knowing that, right, I'm wondering, mm-hmm. when you walked in, no, I probably shouldn't say that, but did you automatically think, I'm having a heart attack, or did somebody else come up with that for you?
So I guess motivated me to go to the emergency room is that there's a couple things, like, especially with women and symptoms of heart attacks, there's some variations compared to men. But I also have long or prolonged QT syndrome, which is heart related. And by the time I got to the ER, I labeled it as a cardiac event, because I wasn't sure if I was having a heart attack. Because, like, for example, for women, they'll say tiredness and fatigue is common in women who are experiencing heart attack, but not necessarily men. The unfortunate thing is I have fibromyalgia, and I'm also diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. So I feel tired and fatigued and exhausted all the time. So that's hard for me to differentiate. But what really honed in that I felt like I was having some sort of heart issue was that my symptoms were progressing, okay. and getting worse, okay. to the point where I could barely sit up straight when I was waiting in the emergency room for well over 2 hours to receive appropriate cardiac treatment.
Okay. Well, gotcha. I had a what I consider to be a cardiac event several, maybe 4 years ago. In the middle of the night, like 2 a.m., I woke up and it felt like there was an elephant sitting on my chest, and I'm like, this is a heart attack. I'm going down. So I called an ambulance, and they took me in, and they processed me pretty quickly, but it turned out to be a burrito.
Well, burritos can be...
It was a...
I mean, they do... Yeah. They do affect my heart, but was, in a loving way.
It was just, it was like a football-sized burrito, and I should not have eaten the whole thing, and it caused me massive discomfort. And
all kidding aside, with that, was it the quantity or was it like the spices? And
I don't. Maybe it was both, but. Oh, yeah. I, honest to God, I said, well, now I think I know what a heart attack feels like, because it was horrible. And they said, no, it's not. I had to let them talk me into the fact that it was a bad case of indigestion.
Well, I've got some questions about that, but yeah.
But that's right.
Yeah. No, and hopefully we'll touch on that in a little bit. But getting back to what happened with you, Crystal, how did you actually get to the emergency room?
So actually, my stepfather took me because of where they live in relation to where I live. It would have been faster than waiting for an ambulance, because I border like two counties and like three counties and three cities. So so he took me, and that's how I arrived, was by family. Pulled up to the emergency room doors, and someone came out with a wheelchair, and I explained my symptoms. And Lita, it makes sense for you to think that you were having a heart attack, because that a typical symptom of a heart attack is that major kind of pressure compression you feel on and within your chest. And it's really hard to explain symptoms of a heart attack because there are such variances from like different genders, age, because I'm 47 and I don't meet any of the demographics for a heart attack.
Right.
So age, gender, overall health can make a difference in the symptoms and severity. So that, you know,
I pulled up. Go back to that a second though, Crystal.
Mm-hmm.
You don't match any of the demographics for a heart attack.
No.
So do you think that there's a built-in bias for emergency room doctors that they don't even bother thinking heart attack if it's a white woman coming in that's in reasonably good health?
Absolutely. And those are some like systemic healthcare biases that we see. So I am not, I have a relatively healthy lifestyle. I'm a good weight. I'm within my BMI index. I'm 47. And the other thing is I have fibromyalgia. And a lot of times when someone with an invisible illness presents to the emergency room, a lot of times, and I experienced this as well, is they'll defer to that main diagnosis. And as a patient, we have to be well-versed and educated in our illnesses, which we'll touch upon later, how I was able to work with the cardiologist to figure out what was going on with me. So when a woman, even though more women die from heart disease than men annually, mm-hmm. we still see this pervasive stereotype that women, especially younger women who don't fit the age demographic for a heart attack, they're often looking at other things, or they might, because they don't think it's a heart attack because they're not well-versed in the symptoms and how they vary in women who are younger, who don't meet the demographics, they'll think it's something else. And then you're waiting for a long time in the emergency room area, which is what happened to me.
Okay.
So my question, and I haven't heard this yet, what kind of tests did they do? Now, I understand if you go in and you're complaining of symptoms of, you know, thinking you might have a heart attack, I know they're going to ask a litany of questions, But mm-hmm. I would have thought that somewhere in this conversation, you would have said they decided to run some tests or things like that, since you did go to the emergency room. Did they do anything like that?
Okay, so this is what is weird, and it kind of gets into triaging, which I understand in a medical emergency room just from my years of experience. But the thing is when I came in, I told them my symptoms. I also told them that I had prolonged QT syndrome, which is a condition that affects the heart. And I told them my symptoms, and I said, I feel like I'm having a cardio or cardiac issue. And I literally signed the consent to release forms and sat in the ER waiting room for over 2 hours. It was actually 2 hours and 38 minutes before I was administered any medication. But the funny thing is, I was seen by a personal care assistant in the intake area where they did blood pressure and took, EKG test. And there was a patient rights violation there. And they did blood work. But the thing of it is that... Give me 1 second. They're upset that I had to go through so much. The thing is that the doctor, and when I say I was sitting in the emergency room for about 2 hours and 32 minutes, is that I was in the waiting area having this cardiac event. The doctor that was on shift until 1200 hours, who did not come out to talk to me, did not come out to eyeball me, didn't ask to speak with my stepfather, ordered a blood test. And that was ordered at like 11:13 a.m. And then the blood work wasn't done until about 12:25 p.m. And by that time, that doctor was off shift, because shift changeover was at 1200, was my understanding for this physician. But the thing of it is that I told him I was suspecting a heart issue going on. They told the doctor, and they did the EKG, and the doctor ordered a blood test because they test a certain kind of like protein mm-hmm. enzyme that right. your heart releases when you're having a heart attack.
Right.
But the doctor never came out to speak to me. The doctor didn't know my history. So that was a bit disturbing for a licensed medical doctor right. to order a test that is typically ordered for someone who might be having a heart attack, but doesn't come out to look or monitor the patient. And that is a major health and safety issue, that you're ordering tests for this potential suspected heart attack, but you have not looked at the patient.
Right.
Wow.
Right.
So, you know, that actually brings up another interesting question. You said your father-in-law took you to the hospital?
My stepfather.
Your stepfather, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Do you think you would have gotten any different treatment if, like, you would have called 911 and had an ambulance pick you up? Because then they would have been talking with the hospital personnel. I don't know. Do you think by going by ambulance versus going by private car made a difference?
Well, yes and no. And there's a systemic issue there that I found out while I was there, which is can be a patient rights. It could be a major life and safety issue. And I can get into that real quick. The problem is every resource and organization, medical provider, cardiologist, informational pamphlets and commercials tell you if you are suspecting any type of heart issue or heart attack, you get to the emergency room as soon as possible, any means possible.
Right. Right.
So for my stepfather to take me was the easiest and fastest right. way. When I was getting my blood pressure done, I asked the care assistant if the emergency room was full, and she said yes. And I was like, okay. And at that point, it was when I first came in, when they do the basic blood pressure, temperature, and all that right. stuff. And she said, well, you're having issues that are typical of a heart attack, it seems, as you're telling me. So they should expedite you, right? But then she says, if you would have came in an ambulance, they would have took you back right away. And I just, and this is, it's just so weird because
why is that? Is that just, is that standard operating procedures that, or is it?
Well, it's, see, it's really weird because I was like, my brain was foggy, but my advocacy hat was on. And I said, well, there's a problem there because sure, probably 92% of the time people that are brought in by an ambulance, it is a medical emergency. It might be more like 90%. Then like triaging is what's important because I'm not saying this happens a lot, but there's sometimes maybe far and few in between, someone could be brought in by ambulance because they broke their leg, right? And that is a medical emergency. But if that fracture is not breaking through the skin or didn't like hit an artery,
inside, right.
Is it a medical emergency? Yes. Is it life threatening? No. And this is where triaging comes in, is you got to look at your patients, right, including the ones that come in the ambulance, and you should be prioritizing first those who have a medical emergency that is life threatening. So when she explained that to me, I'm like, I understand, but that's a system inequity in emergency healthcare departments, because there's times where someone could be brought in and that it's a medical emergency, but not life threatening. And here I technically should be prioritized. And she just kind of looked at me and was like,
well, it's common sense.
Are you a doctor? Well, it is common sense, but here's the other thing. I want to make sure that people understand, I'm not saying that this happens all the time where someone comes in with a medical emergency via ambulance and it's not life-threatening. I'm not saying that's the case, but there are times that that could happen. So what if that was the case for me the day I was in the emergency room? I don't know the other patients that were in there, but did they all have life-threatening issues coming in from an ambulance? The other thing is, when triaging in ER waiting rooms, the hospital that I went to is a designated trauma center, right? And there are people that walk in, and there's some people, they could be having a medical emergency, like they need stitches, or in this time frame they could have COVID. But there are also times where there are people coming in that are at risk or suspected of having a stroke or a pulmonary blood clot, or in my case, a heart attack. And that's where we see some fault in our systems, where we just assume they're brought in by ambulance, get them back there. And a lot of times I was with the combat support hospital, and I had learned from the medics and doctors, like in those situations, someone's brought in, they'll be triaged. It doesn't mean they're necessarily dying, but they're going to be treated with emergency care, but they have to prioritize those based on life and safety.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I live alone. So if something happened, like I fell and broke my leg and I had to get to the hospital, I would have to call an ambulance. I don't have anybody that lives close by me. Now, yeah, is it an emergency? Absolutely, but it's not necessarily life-threatening. So, again, going back to that, when they're triaging people, to me, and I'm probably being oversimplistic, but who has the most serious life-threatening condition or urgency? Again, not that other people don't, but if somebody could potentially die versus somebody, you know, having a broken bone or something, it just, it seems like it should be too simple.
You know, I'm gonna take a very strange right turn here, a detour. I had an experience this week at an emergency. It was not a typical veterinarian, but it was actually an emergency veterinary office. That's all they do is emergencies and surgeries. You don't make an appointment. You know, you only go in if you have an emergency. And I was referred there by my veterinarian, and I thought, in my opinion at the time, that because the two vets talked, that was going to somehow miraculously get me into the door quicker. Number one, it did not. Number two, inside of this emergency veterinary office, they had a chart, a huge chart. I mean, I wanted to take a picture, but I didn't have my phone with me. It was out in the car. In the office, in the waiting room, that had the triage information. Level one, who we see as level one. If the dog is non-responsive, if the dog is unconscious, if the dog is bleeding actively and the bleeding cannot be under control. That was level one. Level two was something a little bit less. Number three was broken legs, like you're saying. You know, not so bad, but you still need to go in for surgery. But they laid it out. Like, in other words, they must be getting a lot of complaints from their customers that they felt it was important to, here it is, people, we consider life-threatening first. Why don't they do that in human hospitals? Why can't they educate us?
Right. Well, to be fair, so just to kind of touch upon some of my experience, like working with individuals in the mental health field, in the intellectual disability field, and veterans alike, I've been to some hospitals where I've seen that, but not all hospitals have displayed that. And I think that would be a great piece of information and resource to have displayed in emergency rooms. What I can tell you,
and it would help the doctors focus. It would give them that focus every day instead of saying
doctors should have that focus. Yeah, that isn't right. I mean, they shouldn't have a tool. They should know how to triage if they're going to work emergency room. But the emergency room I was at didn't have anything like that.
Okay. Yeah, they need something. Well, I guess I'm kind of referring back to our military days where we had training and we had PMs and we had TMs and now
combat medics. Yeah.
It just seems so odd that we're dealing with this.
It's so funny you said that because, and we can loop back to, you know, my experience in the emergency room, and my treatment during the emergency room until the cardiologist came down, he was great. I had a lot of patient rights infractions. The delayed care, 2 hours and 38 minutes before I'm administered any form of treatment, intervention, or medication. And in the instance of a heart attack,
that's a long time.
That is a long time. Treatment should be immediate, right?
Right.
And going through this whole experience, and I have filed a formal patient rights violation grievance because I incurred, I don't know, some ways I was like, I'm like the wrong patient for them to not really ensure that I'm being treated with dignity and respect and treated as like an equal member of the team to try to get to the bottom of what's going on. But simple, basic, timely access to appropriate medical care. But then I was like, nah, I'm the right patient because they don't know who's coming in through those doors and who, right. And who knows what. And so they kind of, in a metaphorical sense, poked a sleeping bear.
Yes.
But I actually said, I did give the hospital the opportunity to try to resolve this and address this through their patient representative. But what bothered me with that, it was a phone call a couple days after I was discharged. They had the nurse manager that was on shift until 1200 hours. And when a patient is filing or expressing a patient rights grievance, they need to be able to do so in a neutral way and explain what happened without parties who were directly or indirectly involved in that care. So one of the things I said to them was, you know, it would probably behoove your hospital system to actually hire or contract with a military combat support hospital. And here's a couple in Ohio. They can teach you appropriate triaging. Techniques. Yeah. I mean, I know that, and a lot of people, and that's why people are like, Crystal, they call me hardcore Crystal, because I'm direct. I'm not disrespectful. I don't, you know, curse people out, but I don't have time to have a lovely conversation about how my patient rights were violated. It's here's the problem, here's some solutions. Right. And the thing of it is that you know, it's very complicated what happened to me because there were several infractions. But at the end of the day, while there was no resolution with this patient representative, and I have moved it to the next level, is I just said, I just want to see all the ER staff retrained on patient rights. I don't need names or whatnot, but how many people were trained and the dates that it was administered. And I'd like an answer within 30 days in writing if this is going to happen or not. And they were kind of like, well, we can't make that decision. And I was like, there's a patient rights violation. You can make this decision.
Joint Commission could make that decision for them. Do they want you to take it over their head?
This is a problem with patients when they run into issues trying to advocate for themselves and these barriers. Again, it's kind of like walking in, not meeting the Democrat. I didn't walk in. I was in a wheelchair, just to clarify, because I couldn't walk. But again, this is why it's so important to, you know, when you asked earlier, did I know I was having a heart attack? And I answered, I knew I was having a cardiac event. And part of that is being a well-educated person, especially in certain age groups and demographics and stuff that we're more at risk for certain medical conditions or medical emergencies. So it's important to know the basics about certain things, especially at my age as I get older. You know, certain things like heart attack, knowing those symptoms. But the other thing is, if you have other medical conditions, such as I do, is you have to be well informed on those, because there could be a lot of intersectionality going on, which is what happened with myself. And so that knowledge, I always say knowledge is power and your best weapon or best tool. And so because I was well informed on my medical conditions, which helped the cardiologist zone in on what really caused my heart attack, the thing of it is that then you're aware of what's going on around you and if they're providing the care they should be in the way they should be. And so when I noted that they weren't, I was very forward and said, you know, you need a contract to combat support hospital, like their personnel to come in and teach you all how to triage, because it was a hot mess and I could have died. Yeah. And that's what I said exactly.
Right. Okay.
I don't mince words.
Yeah. Well, let's circle back to the script. I think that was important to get out. Crystal, what is the difference between a heart attack and a sudden cardiac arrest?
So, you know, I'm not necessarily an expert on heart conditions, but 9 times out of 10, like cardiac arrest, your heart has stopped.
Okay.
So that's just the best way to explain that. And the reasons why it did could be for a variety of reasons.
Right. Could be electrical, could be.
Sure. Yeah. Heart disease, a blocked, you know, could be anything. And then where a heart attack, while serious and can be life-threatening, you can die. Again, it depends on what is triggering the heart attack. And if you get timely treatment, you have a good outcome of surviving with hopefully minimal issues that have, you know, affected the heart.
So they diagnosed yours finally as a heart attack or a cardiac event?
A heart attack.
Okay.
And semi, it's so, I know a lot of information about different medical things, but I can't pronounce the words.
Okay. All right.
But what happened was when they finally called down a cardiologist and we started talking, and I said, well, these are my symptoms. I do have prolonged QT syndrome, and I also have Raynaud's syndrome. And he looked, and he even looked at my fingers. He's like, yes, I can see like your fingers are like whitish blue, the tips. And as we started talking, he said, well, there was a small abnormality on my EKG between the Q and T interval, which would be normal for me because I have prolonged QT syndrome. And he said, you know, you're not overweight and you're typically younger than what is expected for a heart attack in women. And Raynaud's syndrome does cause spasms and constriction of your blood vessels and arteries, including in your heart. And he said, but we're, he's like, I feel like it's more related to the Raynaud's, but we're going to do a procedure, cardio catheter, to check to see if there's any heart disease or any blockage in your arteries. And so that was the next step after giving me medication. Like, my blood pressure was ridiculously high.
Oh.
It was. It was like 173 over, I believe it was like 127, 128.
Wow.
Well, wouldn't that be common, though, with a heart attack?
Yeah, but not that's, for, what's your, what is your typical blood pressure?
So I'm usually like 110 on.
Right.
So, like over 90 or 100 over 80.
So,
and the other thing
that
is,
that should have triggered the triage people right there, right?
I would assume it would have. I mean, I know it would in my mind. So yeah, and so a lot of times if you're having a cardiac event and suspected heart attack, they might not necessarily know it's triggering it until they do further testing. And like, my blood work came back. And what, and this is another thing, is knowing what's typical for you, but right. They say like usually that protein your heart releases when you're having a heart attack is like around 10,000, maybe higher, right? The number is like 10,000 or higher. Mine was like, that's when they like know for sure. But mine was like over 1,000. And that didn't surprise me. And the cardiologist said, you know, with your medical history and Raynaud's and fibromyalgia, you know, this could be way abnormal for you, but extremely on the low abnormal side for someone else. And I said, exactly. I have different tests up for different issues that have mm-hmm. been done that
right.
kind of
right.
mimic that.
Right.
So the going in and looking, you know, through a catheter up into my heart is what 100% gave like that stamp of, okay, I had no heart disease. The cardiologist said that my arteries were as clean as a whistle. So I had no like blockage, no plaque buildup, any of that. And he deduced, he's like, yeah, as suspected, your Raynaud's caused an artery in your heart to start spasming and constrict, which reduced blood flow, which led to the cardiac.
Okay.
Like heart attack.
Right.
So yeah, and that's the thing too. We think heart disease, we think high blood pressure, we think blocked arteries, but again, it's really having to self-educate yourself on the symptoms of your variety of medical conditions, like I did for myself, so that you can articulate, because that helps them kind of maybe roll out some things or kind of zero
right.
in
mm-hmm.
on what they should be looking at.
Sure.
So, how common are heart attacks here in the U.S.?
So I think I read, I can't remember if it was like 80,000 or maybe 800,000. 800,000 sounds high. So I think something like 80,000 people yearly experience some type of cardiac event, heart attack.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that. For some reason, I don't know. And that might be for women.
Okay. All right. Well,
yeah,
we'll
that does sound kind of low. And
that
again,
sounds kind of low, yeah.
I mean, we're not obviously not holding
it
to you.
Since heart disease is one of the largest killers.
I think it's number one.
Yeah. Well, I didn't
for
know
women, it's number one. And that's why I'm thinking that 80,000 is
might
more for... It might be more specific for women,
okay,
versus looking at, you know, all genders.
Sure.
But my understanding is, I remember back in like the 90s, they would say 1 out of 10 people will experience a heart attack. And I think it's like 1 out of 5 or 4 now.
Okay.
Wow.
But again, this is basic information, and I've been given a lot of information, and just kind of going through the process with prolonged QT syndrome, as they often zero in on what it's like for women.
All right. Dominic just came up with an answer. 805,000 for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
605,000 are heart attacks.
Okay. Yeah. And then figuring out which, yeah. I know it's high.
Yeah.
And then how many people actually pass away from a heart attack, I don't know.
Okay. Well, we'll have to get right. those figures and put it on our website.
Right. Is there anything you personally can do to prevent, or anything anybody can do to prevent future heart attacks and maintain overall heart health? I mean, what are your recommendations?
I know a lot of times that heart attacks are linked to like heart disease, artery, you know, disease, and lifestyles. So there's a lot of things within our control to reduce the risk. And that's, you know, I like to say the term physically active instead of exercise, because there's so many ways to get out and be physically active, and that's important. So a sedentary lifestyle will increase your risk of a heart attack. Age, not necessarily in my case, but age, as we get older, it increases the risk. You know, stress levels are a lot of times, I feel like, even though it's identified, it's not really focused on enough, but stress, because stress can lead to anxiety and all these other mental health issues. But, you know, weight, smoking. I don't know. I was reading how, like, in some instances, consuming too much alcohol could contribute, but then you read how, like, red wine is actually good for your heart. So I find that confusing. But yeah, so those are some of the typical risk factors, is like age, your weight, your lifestyle, your eating habits. But the other thing is, if you have other medical conditions, how well you're managing
right.
those.
Absolutely.
As well, on top of that.
Right, right. And are you able to resume your day-to-day activities? I don't remember how long ago this happened, but are you back to quote-unquote normal?
So, no, it's been 2.5 weeks, since I've had the heart attack. And am I back to normal activities? No, it's you kind of got to just approach each day and maybe mm-hmm. add something new. They say that on average it could take anywhere from 1 to 3 months to fully recover. I do feel that for myself, because I'm younger, that works in my favor in this. But no, but as time goes on, it's interesting, because after having a heart attack, you can have angina, and you can feel lightheaded. There's a lot of brain fog issues, which I've experienced, which is, goes above and beyond the brain fog with fibromyalgia. And it's all I can do is laugh with that, because someone has called me more than once, different people, and I know I want to accept the call and talk to them, but for some reason my brain is like hit decline, and I'm like, what am I doing? So yeah, it's there are things that I'm gonna liken it to this. It's like if you break your leg and then someone a couple of weeks later is like, go run a marathon. Doesn't work like that with a heart attack. And if you overdo it, you're putting strain on your heart. Your heart is a muscle. When you have a heart attack, you have, in a sense, injured that muscle.
Right.
So if you're doing too much too soon, you're stressing it, and you actually increase your risk of having another cardiac event. And something like 42% of women who have a heart attack have one within a year of the
wow.
initial heart attack.
Oh.
So you got to take it day by day, and you got to add in activities as your body can tolerate. And if you do too much, you're going to feel it. You're going to be like, oh, wow, my heart actually hurts. Like the way a muscle would hurt if it was injured.
Yeah.
So because your heart is a muscle.
So you were saying you're not like back to normal day-to-day activities, but are you going to like cardiac rehab, or what are you personally doing right now to kind of get back to your everyday activities?
So, a cardio rehabilitation program is to help you reduce risk of future heart attacks. And it's to help you kind of strengthen post heart attack. And some of the things that they address is lifestyle, weight.
Okay.
So for me, not all that stuff applies.
Okay.
So, but there's other things like managing stress afterwards. And there's a lot of stress because of the patient rights violations, and I'm exhausted, but I'm trying to chip away at the process with the patient rights grievance. So those programs are great. And in my case, I have to tailor it because like, I don't need to lose weight. And since the heart attack, I've actually lost 4 pounds, which is about 2 pounds a week. And I'm not someone who should be losing weight. So that part of the program wouldn't apply to me.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. Right. I was under the impression though, at like the cardiac rehab places, that they would put the lead cords on you and kind of monitor you as you're like maybe walking the treadmill, just to kind of see that everything is at a normal rate.
Yeah, I don't know if they go through that much.
I thought they did. I could be wrong.
You know, I mean, I also think it just depends on how proactive a cardiology department or rehab program is, especially if there's a lot of complications or other factors. I know that the program I'm looking at that isn't part of it. It's focusing on improving your overall wellness to reduce risk of experiencing a heart attack in the future.
Okay. What advice do you have for somebody that feels their healthcare provider just is not listening to them or taking their concerns seriously?
One of the things I hear a lot in different communities is they don't feel that their doctor is listening, but they're not speaking the patient. And part of it is they don't understand their patient rights. So first of all, you really have to read up on what your patient rights are so that you know, for example, like when I had the EKG done, it was done in the intake area and it was a room, but my shirt was up and the door facing, it was eastward facing to the ER was open. And then people were walking in and out of the door behind me, which walks out to the ER. Some people went, and here's the thing, I felt horrible because I'm having this heart attack and it's like you just are almost like disconnected. It's like, you're so sick. The symptoms are so pervasive that it's hard to focus. But I knew my patient rights and I was kind of just laying there and I had a sports bra on. So it's not that big of a deal per se, but I said to the personal care assistant, I said, you know, you should probably put a sheet over me because people are walking through, they're walking to the ER waiting room. Right. The door in front of me is open. It doesn't matter if they're medical personnel or not, because I do have the right to dignity and respect. Mm-hmm. And she just kind of looked at me like, And so that's the thing, is know your patient rights. Right. Whenever possible, have someone with you. Because of my experience with so many violations on my patient rights, I was using my phone notepad and using talk to text just to document certain things and time frames. An example is when they finally did draw my blood, about an hour and 5 or 10 minutes after it was ordered, they didn't do it in the emergency room department. I was taken back to a hallway in the emergency room and the phlebotomist was drawing my blood in a hallway. And then she left because she saw a colleague walking down the hall. And she was like, I'll be right back. I'll be right back. Cause she was calling down to her colleague about attending something which is not related to what was going on with me medically. She left me unattended and went around the corner of the hallway to talk to her colleague, and I was only like left alone a little bit over 60 seconds, right? But there was no one else in that hallway to monitor me. I was left with a heart attack with no medical personnel around. And people might think that 60 seconds or so is not that big of a deal, but 60 seconds can be a determinant in whether someone lives or dies. So, you know, I was put in this position where I had to fight for my healthcare. But part of the reason why I was able to was I knew my patient rights. I had my stepfather with me. when I just was like, I need you to go up to the desk or speak with this person and tell them this exactly. Because I just didn't have the energy, even being pushed in a wheelchair, to do it.
Yeah.
And like I said, I had to document some stuff. The other thing is, every step of the way, I told every person in that emergency room, going all the way up into inpatient, the cardiac inpatient unit, everything I incurred in the emergency room. I was extremely vocal about all my patient rights and how they were violated. And I'm at the point where when they first took me up to my room, when I was hospitalized, I told the nurse if she had, this was what was interesting. She told me what my patient rights were. And that was the first time anyone has said anything about patient rights. And I said, you know what? I appreciate you reviewing that with your patients, because people don't know. And I had all this happen, and I was contemplating being asked to be transported to another medical care facility.
Huh?
Because I couldn't trust them anymore. Oh, I couldn't trust that they were going to treat me with dignity, respect. By the time I was hospitalized, I had so many patient rights infractions that I just felt that I couldn't trust their care anymore.
Okay.
So I lost faith in their ability to even care for me, because as a human being, they didn't treat me well.
Right.
Right.
Huh. Well, what does this upcoming year look like for you?
As far as that, or just in general?
As I guess in general, because we know that you're not going to take that one laying down.
Nope. As I already outlined, I've already started the process of filing a patient rights grievance. And I've been also documenting every step of that process on social media, just so that I can teach other people, hopefully, what their patient rights are and different ways to address them. But also, it's some accountability for the hospital emergency room. But on top of contending with that, I do live with fibromyalgia, and I am a veteran. So there's going to be some initiatives coming up for both fibromyalgia and the veteran community for awareness and advocacy from state level to federal level, some legislative advocacy. And I think for the time being, because those things are already on my radar and I plan on doing, that's all I'm going to do for the next 4 or 5 months. And then take a break.
Okay.
Hopefully. I always say that every year, though, but it never happens.
Try it this year.
Yeah, we were talking about lifestyles. I don't think you have a sedentary lifestyle.
No.
Fortunately, because of technology, there's so much I can do from my computer and from home. So that really is a helpful tool and way to accommodate my medical conditions without burning myself out or putting too much stress on myself physically or mentally.
Right.
Deal.
Yeah. So Crystal, where can our listeners learn more about you, your advocacy, and also the puppies, the ones that we just heard at the beginning?
Oh, yeah. The puppy dogs. I'm on many social media platforms, on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube. You can find me at the Fibromyalgia Pain Chronicles or Veteran Voices for Fibromyalgia. I am on TikTok at Keeping It Real with Crystal, and the website, veteranvoicesforfibromyalgia.com. And I'm on LinkedIn too. I'm everywhere.
We'll make sure that we put links on our website.
Yeah.
Thank you for adding those on your bio, because that makes it a lot easier. Crystal, it has, like always, it's been a pleasure to talk with you, and we learned so much. We hope you can join us again in May for another episode on fibro.
I would love to come back. Thank you.
All right. We will put that down for May.
Glad to hear that you are doing well now.
Well, I'm doing better.
Yes.
And hopefully I'll get to the wellness sooner than later.
Right. Thank you, Crystal. If our listeners have any questions or comments related to today's show, they can contact us at podcastdx@yahoo.com, through our website, podcastdx.com. And we're on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, TikTok, and Instagram by the same name.
And if you have a moment to spare, please give us a 5-star review wherever you get your podcast. And as always, Please keep in mind that this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment, and before undertaking a new healthcare regime, and never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast.
Till next week.